Hello, and welcome to another episode of Over Under Movies, where we pick one overrated and one underrated movie and we discuss them. And in this episode, we have two very specific Harlem-based crime films that were picked by our critic, Eric McClanahan. And so I am Octay Ege Kozak, film critic for Oregon Herald, DVD Talk, The Playlist, and Bayaspider.com.
I'm Ryan Oliver, a homeless internet film critic at the moment.
Aww. We'll get you a home soon, son.
We'll find something.
Son.
And I'm Eric.
We'll do one of those like homeless film critic PSAs, like the Sarah McLachlan thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm Eric McClanahan, film writer for The Playlist, Oregon Art Watch, and I have another film podcast called Adjust Your Tracking.
Yeah, Eric's the podcast guy.
Hey.
Yeah. Hey. We're gonna actually like change things up a little bit because we used to start off with our overrated first and then move on to our underrated. We're gonna start off with our underrated film, which is Across 110th Street, the 1972 Harlem crime epic drama, directed by Barry Scheer, who comes from a lot of TV stuff. And yeah, this is Eric, these films are Eric's picks, so let's hand it off to Eric. Why did you pick Cross 110th Street?
Well, for one, I've seen this film now. I only recently came to this movie in terms of discovering it and watching it. And I've seen it three times now in the last couple of years. The second time I saw it, I got to see it at the Hollywood Theater here in Portland. You guys both know that theater. It's in the main auditorium. I got to see a beautiful 35 millimeter print of it. And it's the one time they showed the film. It was just a one-time screening. This was a couple of years ago. And I'm telling you, maybe 10 people were there.
Ooh,
And it
not
was really,
surprised.
yeah, and it was, I guess it was just sad because I just think this is a very plain and simple, uncomplicated, underrated pick. It's just a film not enough people have seen or even know about, but they know that song now. From, you know,
Jackie
mostly,
Brown.
exactly, from Quentin Tarantino using the Bobby Womack song Across 110th Street. He uses it to open and close Jackie Brown. He uses it really beautifully in that movie. And it's a beautiful song, memorable song. So a lot of people know that, but I think this is one of those movies that if you know that, you know, if you know Jackie Brown and you liked it, you got to go back because Across 110th Street is one of the like best examples of a New York crime movie, I think, from an era that I love the most, the 70s. And also it gets lumped into the blaxploitation genre, but I think what I, yeah, exactly. It doesn't fit that. And I think that's actually doing the film a disservice. I think this film is just a beautiful, like well-made, well-balanced crime film. So, yeah, that's like the broad sort of overall thoughts on it. But I don't know. What did you guys think? I'm dying to know because I just think this is a film more people should see.
Well, I've seen it before a while ago, and the reason I liked it and I was kind of surprised by it because of what you said, that it's mostly known to be a blaxploitation picture, but I think that's because it does have a little bit of that style, and especially with the Bobby Womack score with the wah-wah pedals and the you know, every one of those blaxploitation films have their own theme song. That the song, the lyrics of the song is the title of the movie, you know, so it fits
Shaft,
into, yeah, exactly, it fits into,
Superfly.
yeah, all of those, Dolomite.
Yep.
This is as far away from Dolomite as you can get quality-wise, I should say, if you're a blaxploitation aficionado.
Exactly.
And it's, it has some of those elements, and, you know, it deals with urban crime and all that stuff as well, but I think it's a lot. It doesn't fit thematically into the blaxploitation genre. It's not really about, you know, exploiting the sex and the violence around, because blaxploitation is more of a style than a genre. Like Blackula is blaxploitation, and that's like a horror spoof comedy type thing. And you know, it has a lot of violence, a lot of gunplay, a lot of naked women. Yeah, it's exploitation for black people. That's all it comes out to. And Black or White, Across 110th Street is not an exploitation film.
Exactly. Well, and even the racial dynamic is a major is like a major function of the movie, right? I mean,
yeah, and it handles it in a very like level-headed adult way. Like
exactly.
it's not crass, but it's not like Crash level, like, Kumbaya either.
You know? Seriously, this movie was so ahead. Like, this is a movie where if people think Crash is a well-balanced racial, like, examination, yeah. I just send them back to this movie as well.
It does an amazing job. So before we get deep into it, Ryan, what'd you think of it?
I'm going to sound like Eric's Adjust Your Tracking co-host, Joe, but I appreciated this movie more than I actually enjoyed watching it.
All right.
I appreciate that, you know, I know it's been lumped in the blaxploitation genre, and visually, like Octay already commented on, I was going to say, visually it is, from some of the zoom shots and kind of the murky cinematography, sometimes to the point where it's hard to even tell what's going on. Maybe they were limited by their budget, I don't know. But I appreciate that the movie is, I appreciate its authenticity. I appreciate that it takes into account those racial tensions that are going on in Harlem and most likely still are going on in Harlem. Like, it's still a very relevant movie. It still holds up today as a very well racial commentary. So I appreciate this movie. I just didn't necessarily find much to enjoy about it. I don't know what happened there with that for me. Maybe it was just too late and I was tired. Maybe it was on me. I don't know.
Maybe you're just racist. It's okay.
I have some good things to say about our overrated movie. So I feel like I'm like the contrarian.
This is going to get interesting. And is that something that Joe says a lot? Like, I appreciate it more than
he does.
I liked it. Oh, okay.
At least in this last year, it seems like every episode I listen to is Gesture Tracking.
All the movies I love, he appreciates usually.
Okay. Yeah. It's like a nice way of saying like, yeah, you're kind of like overvaluing this a little bit.
Exactly.
But it's a well-constructed movie. Like, there's no doubt about that. And if this paved the way for other movies that I love that deals with similar subject matter, like Do the Right Thing, or like maybe even some of those urban, like Boys in the Hood type crime dramas, great. I'm glad this movie exists. I'm happy.
Other thing is, though, I don't want to paint this film as like an issues movie by any means. I just think you just have the racial dynamic is at the core of the two lead characters, and I think the cast is one of the things to really I think you can't help but praise for a movie like this. With I think Yaphet Kotto's performance is phenomenal, and you counter that with Anthony Quinn playing just this grizzled it's easy to call the Anthony Quinn character, who's this grizzled old cop. He's been at it for a while, and they're both trying to solve a crime in the film together. But there's the conflict of the fact that Quinn has been doing this job for a while. Yaphet Kotto's new, and he kind of got the job because, like, basically as like a political move. And I just think that it's easy to write off a character or write a character in this kind of a movie as a pure one-note racist bad guy.
Yeah, exactly.
But Anthony Quinn's character is actually really layered and complex. And the first time I saw this film, I thought, oh, he's just a racist cop that like has to learn a lesson by the end of the movie. And boy, does he learn... I mean, I thought it was like him learning a lesson at the end of this movie. I will say also, without spoiling, Across 110th Street has a shocking like last scene.
Right.
I think, exactly. And I think it works really well because the more I watched this film, I actually saw it. It was became more clear to me how layered and complex his character is. That you get interactions where he's a cop working in Harlem. Like he deals with all kinds of races all the time. He's just a guy that's. I compare this movie to something like The French Connection. You know, like the Gene Hackman character in that is like he's a racist. He uses. Racial slurs, right? Like, but it's honest. That's what I like about Across 110th Street as well. It's a good little nifty, tiny crime movie. It's really, it's honest.
The difference between, I was going to bring up French Connection as well, because I think the biggest difference between that and Across 110th Street is that French Connection is mostly about, you know, the title itself, The French Connection, and it has these like little slivers where they're like harassing black people, and you know, there's this one like infamous bar scene that became like, you know, kind of the black community's way of saying like, hey, that's, you know, that kind of abuse is finally in a major motion picture that people can see how we're regularly being treated.
Yep.
And but yeah, that's just one scene, and what I love about Across 110th Street is that the entire story takes place in that world.
Yeah.
So it kind of expands it out to the kind of racial dynamics between the police and the you know, the two police officers, one white, one black, which could have gone horribly wrong into like schlocky kind of, you know, let's hold hands and work together type of thing, and it doesn't really work out that way. But yeah, it really goes far ahead in terms of like to see, you know, it's interesting because it doesn't pit Anthony Quinn as the quintessential kind of antagonist bad guy. It's a little bit of like an equal opportunity kind of like showing you both sides of the angle, and they both have their glaring faults. Mm-hmm. But it does this like really hard thing to do, and I think that's what you mean by like how much depth this character has.
Yes.
That you don't agree with what he does, but you identify with it. Like, you understand how he got to that place.
Mm-hmm.
And why he's harassing these people. I mean, he can't even, like, there's this really beautiful scene near the beginning where Yaphet Kotto is interrogating one of the suspects of the big kind of takedown, the robbery that happens. And, you know, the guy's just, like, kind of skittish, but he doesn't, like, really, he's still, like, kind of there. And Anthony Quinn just shows up, and he kind of just, like, lifts his hand to, like, straighten his hair or something, and you can see the guy like twitch because he's like, he's gonna hit me, like he knows him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just like his go-to answer. He just like walks in the room and starts beating up black people,
right?
And it's just like this, the dynamic in the scene, like you can see like really, really well directed, kind of going into the details of like the actors. And I guess that's like from the director, coming from you know, Barry Scheer, coming from the world of TV where you have to be like efficient within like a small space of time.
Yeah, this is a fascinating film in terms of, you know, you like a movie if you find one or discover it. I think all of us want to know about who directed it. And this was a name I know very little about. Mm-hmm. And it kind of seems like this was his one great film, at least in terms of how much I care about this movie.
Well, it doesn't look like he even did many films at all, just mostly episodes of television. And
exactly. And, but he had like a long career.
And TV movies for the most part.
I only see 1, 2, 3 features.
Yeah.
So that's not a lot.
No.
But you have to like really kind of dig in there and skim through his long, long list of TV stuff to get to. And it does have that kind of like immediate TV feeling, like lots of like handheld stuff, lots of documentary style, which wasn't really that popular back then, you know.
Yeah.
Became kind of like a thing in the 90s later on, and you know, 70s has a lot of stuff like that, but I feel like it's a little bit more stylized. It's a little bit more like the camera movements and everything is a bit more controlled.
Yeah, I think what it does, the style of this movie, is help make it feel small and insular. Like, the world it takes place in and the time period it takes place in is a very small, like, window of time in a very small little, like, nook of Harlem. And I think that actually works in the movie's favor, is, like, how small it is, and that's how you get an intimate sort of dissection of all versions of this crime. Like, the opening of the movie has this great heist that goes wrong but also goes right in a way, you know. It's like the entire film, it's sort of complicated in that way. And I just love how the intimacy of it, the fact that the crime is kind of small, and it allows them to sort of dig into all these various characters. Like, there, you don't just bless you.
Yeah, thank you. You heard that? Yeah. I was trying to cover it the best.
It's all right. It's all right. Yeah, you don't just learn about these two main characters like Yaphet Kotto and Anthony Quinn. Like, they're just a part of this puzzle, right?
Yeah.
And I love that about this film. Like, you have intimate scenes with all the criminals that are involved in the heist. There's three of them, and you know, it doesn't go right for some of them, or all of them, really. But I love that you get all these moments with them, and they're all like flesh and blood characters. Yeah. I actually think that's really an achievement that, you know, Barry Scheer didn't get to do much in feature films, but like, clearly, like, his style works really well for this movie.
Oh yeah. And very, very, you know, influential, decades later, that's for sure.
Oh,
and,
I mean, do you guys, I think The Wire doesn't exist if you don't have something like Across 110th Street. Like,
yeah, they must have been at least influenced by something like this.
Oh, I think David Simon, for sure. Like, in terms of the, like, his other work is done, like Homicide, I think, and The Corner, the first thing he did for HBO, I think it's called The Corner.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that stuff is very indebted to the style of something like Across 110th Street. for sure.
Yeah, yeah, and the structure of it, giving equal time to the criminals and the cops and the intimate lives that they all have, is just like very reminiscent of Heat.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But isn't it amazing? Like every time I watch Across 110th Street, I'm like, I marvel at the efficiency of it. Though it's an hour and 42 minutes,
yeah.
Yet you get a complete picture of this crime and the rippling effects, yeah. And also all aspects of it. It's very journalistic in that way.
Yeah.
And I also think it's got to be a huge influence on something like Traffic. I think Steven Soderbergh must have been like, had this movie in his brain while he was making Traffic. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely possible. The wire angle definitely like makes a lot
right?
of sense.
Right.
And especially, you know, not just only the subject matter, you know, East Coast crime and the cops and the, you know, the impossibility of getting anywhere with the
yes.
the red tape and the corruption. And,
there's a very cynical point of view that both this film and The Wire, like, it's it plays in with the honesty, I feel, of it. It is a cynical thing. And Ryan, maybe this is partially why you didn't enjoy it. I don't know. I'm curious. Is like, it is sort of a tough pill to swallow as a movie. Is that maybe something that kept you from enjoying it?
No, I don't think that necessarily, because there's plenty of other very cynical movies that I have had no problem enjoying. Something like Killing Them Softly, for example.
Good example.
That we talked about on the Town Friends of Eddie Coyle episode. Like, I love that movie despite how cynical it is. And maybe it was just, again, maybe I just watched this too late at night, or something was up with this, or something was up with the sound mix. Like, I had trouble hearing what people were saying, like even putting the subtitles on. And there was that, like, which I would normally appreciate. There was almost that like Altman level of like layering dialogue,
yes,
like, especially during a lot of investigation scenes, which I would normally appreciate. But I just felt like it was hard for me to tell exactly what was going on. I mean, I knew the base story. It's this you know, robbery that's relatively small. But other than that, I had trouble keeping track of the characters and exactly how it was affecting them in which way. And then again, that's something that's maybe more on me than it is the movie itself.
Well, it packs in a lot, like Eric said, into an hour and 42 minutes. Like, it packs in. The thing about it is that it efficiently packs in more story, I feel like, than, you know, our overrated pick into an hour and 42 minutes.
I can't argue that.
Yeah. And but yeah, it does get a little bit complicated near the end. Maybe if you check it out, you know, sometime later, and
I definitely,
you know, it might work out better for you. My only issue with it is that I guess that's kind of a backhanded compliment in a way, that the Anthony Quinn and the Yaphet Kotto scenes are so good.
Yes.
That the third act kind of turns into, okay, like, let's go after the criminals, and the mob element comes in.
Yes.
And I was like, oh man, I wish there was a little bit more of that relationship in the third act. Because the final three or four scenes are all about, like, okay, now the mob's going to get the criminals and the police are going after them. And it turns into an impressively well shot, for its time at least, like kind of like balls out action scene with like a submachine gun out of all things, like it just like comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And this guy's like brandishing a submachine gun, like mowing down. And it's and another issue with that, of course, is that it's a gun that doesn't run out of bullets. Like, it just turns into an action flick all of a sudden. But that's the only, that would be my only criticism. But otherwise, yeah.
I don't know. I felt like that scene, the machine gun maybe comes out of nowhere in terms of how intimate and small we've been talking about the movie is. And, like, where did that character get it? But I don't know. I feel like that's a pretty self-contained, like, little, you know, moment. It's not like a huge action scene.
No.
But I feel like the movie is building up to, like, it gives you, I guess that's another thing I love about this movie, is it is still, like, gives you these sort of great crime, the generic crime elements that I really love in movies, my favorite genre. Like, this is gonna just be a motif for me, a repeating thing where I'm probably gonna usually mine crime movies that I love for my underrated picks, because it's just the type of movies I love the most. And I love how something like Across 110th Street can be really low key but still give you those moments, the action beats, the almost like silly, like, this movie, I would even say this movie's kind of goofy at times, where
it gets there.
I think you guys, maybe you were familiar already with the actor Antonio Fargas from something like, did you guys ever see the Wayans Brothers movie, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker?
I actually have not seen that.
Oh, man. That's a good one. It's pretty goddamn funny, I will say. It's really funny.
It's like Walk Hard, though. Like, you should have seen the movies that it spoofs to, like, get the joke.
Or even, like, Black Dynamite. Black Dynamite.
But see, I would say I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker is more of an overt spoof than even Black Dynamite. Black Dynamite's more Grindhouse than Wayne Brothers. Yeah, like
Black
scary.
Dynamite is more like Hot Fuzz, where it's just like it spoofs the genre while being the genre at the same time.
Yeah. Right.
I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker is straight up like Airplane.
Exactly. Oh,
or like Don't Be a Menace to South Central.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like a black exploitation version of that.
Makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, he's in that.
And Antonio Fargas is hilarious in that movie, but really, you could take his character from Across 110th Street and just turn him into this ridiculous pimp, and that's the character. And I'm gonna
he's
get
mostly
you
known for those there in Starsky and Hutch.
Right, there you go. So he's like twisting on all these characters that he played in his career and something like that. But I think you can appreciate something like I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker even more when you've seen like Across 110th Street, because it does relish in the sort of like he's a part of the crime, we could say, and Antonio Fargas in the beginning. And he, does he party his ass off when he realizes how much money they got away with. But I just think like the movie... Yeah. Has that style, has the things that I think are overrated pick, my overrated pick, kind of misses even, is the goof, like, I guess Across 110th Street, I think Barry Scherer, the director, was able to sort of balance even the goofy aspects with when the film ultimately becomes very serious and, you know, quite cynical by the end. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it knows exactly when to go over the top.
Exactly.
Like when Antonio Fargas is partying and there's all these, like, Dutch angles and like, you know, weird handheld shots and
his clothes,
his clothes especially.
Oh my god, they're amazing.
This must have been the film that got him Huggy Bear, because this is before Starsky and Hutch,
right?
And of course, he became a self parody by the time you get to I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. But he's a really like expressive, really like it just whenever he pops up on screen anywhere, he just like attracts your attention. And I think Yaphet Kotto is an actor who does that exact same thing in a completely different way. Like,
his
heft and gravitas is, it's like Sidney Poitier won for In the Heat of the Night, and it's kind of like the same kind of dynamic, like the black cop comes into like a mostly white kind of police environment and tries to make himself accepted. But I think this was like on the same level of quality as Sidney Poitier, and it probably just didn't get a lot of attention.
Right.
And I think, you know, what you said about the submachine gun and the action scene at the end, that's just like a little nitpick. The thing that I was really harping on was that those scenes with the dynamic between Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto were so good that I really wanted more of that.
And I'll give you that too, especially with the way the movie ends. Like, I guess if you had more of that, it might have even, had a greater impact with the way the movie ends. I'll give you that. I can give you that. But got to appreciate it's the efficiency.
Like it does such a good, job with those characters. With the other, the crime element and the mob boss and everything, like, those are good too. But the cop stuff that especially like ties directly into something like The Wire were handled really well. Like the everything from the cinematography to the production design and how grainy everything is and how unpleasant it looks. It doesn't look sleek and stylish. And I think the director coming from TV having to, you know, kind of cater to the general audience and make cop shows look sexy and like fun and interesting. Mm-hmm. I think maybe he got tired of having to do that and put together this movie that just, you know, like you see like a wide shot of a, like a precinct, and it's just like crowded and grimy and full of people, and Anthony Quinn can't even like make it past the corridor without being hassled by like 10 different people, and it's loud. It's just like the exact opposite of what the audience have seen on TV about, you know, you see a cop show, even in the 70s and 80s, it's just, you know, breezy and empty, and people are just like cracking jokes, and it's just like a fun kind of, it almost looks like a workplace sitcom or something, and I think he did an amazing job with that. So the realism of it is what captured me a lot more than, you know, because the story itself is kind of a basic, you know, crime story.
Yeah.
Nothing really that interesting happens in it, but it doesn't...
Right, and the heist is like... Those. The heist isn't like super elaborate, like in films like you know, Rafifi or Thief or Le Cirque Rouge. Like, it isn't all about the heist. The heist is like the inciting incident and used as a springboard for like the consequences of something like this. And that's another thing I think a lot of the, like a great crime film or just I think a great film in general, comedies, anything, just has to have. And I think it's what helps it feel honest and real is like there has to be consequences to the, what the characters do. And I really love how Across 110th Street is all about the consequences to a crime like this. Like it's Breaking Bad would do that sort of thing where it was about you do one thing and there's always this ripple effect, right? The ramifications, and Breaking Bad was all about that in a lot of ways. I don't know. I really appreciate when I find early examples of stuff that I've come to love in my my generation. You know, things we're referencing The Wire, Breaking Bad, Traffic, things that I grew up and have like experienced and loved watching. But seeing older versions of it, I'm like, I always love that. And I think really that's what Across 110th Street is to me, and why it really just it should. I just wish more people would see it, I hope it's seen out there. It needs to be seen. I think it's a really, really great ahead of its time crime flick.
Yeah, it's a hard film to get your hands on. I mean, we had to like rent it finally on YouTube. Like, it's not really available streaming. It's hard to get your hands on physical media. Period these days anyway.
There is a Blu-ray but I've been keeping track of it, but it's still at about the $20-$22 marks or price on Amazon, so I'm kind of holding off. But you can rent it on YouTube for $3.99 HD, and that's what I did. And
you can rent it on Amazon as well. That's how I watched it. Yep.
Oh, cool. Yeah. It's definitely like, especially if you're fans of you know, gritty kind of 70s crime dramas. I don't think this gets enough respect in those terms. I don't think it's a great masterpiece, like, you know, something like Mean Streets or something like that. And, you know, like it has some of those problems that I mentioned, but it's definitely like it's strikingly effective in what it tries to achieve. And So Ryan, specifically, what would you say that you liked about it?
I definitely like the performances of Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto, for sure. Like, and you're talking about films that has influence. I could also see influences, possibly movies like 48 Hours and Lethal Weapon getting influences from that sort of dynamic from them as well. So I especially like the performances and the authenticity of the film. Like, again, maybe the cinematography, like, because I couldn't quite tell sometimes what was going on, bothered me. But I appreciate that this movie is rooted in authenticity, and I would still recommend it to anybody, even though I wasn't, you know, I didn't necessarily love watching it, but I would watch it again.
Yeah, I could totally see that that cinematography, that style was kind of in its baby steps, and I could totally understand that anybody who would watch it would be like, you know, it is. Kind of hard to see what's going on at times with that kind of documentary style approach, and I think that's because that style was like kind of you know, with the technology that they had at the time. Handheld style was that, like, really gritty documentary style was like still kind of in its infancy.
I think they were limited by their resources and their budget, and that's not their fault. That's just what, you know, the hand they were given at the time. I think mostly not even the grimy, just more the lack of light. I mean, we're spoiled now with the type of cameras that pick up low lighting. So it's just what they were limited to. So that's not on them.
Yeah,
that's,
try going out there in the middle of Harlem with a 35mm magazine on your shoulder. Us damn kids, we have it way too easy.
Well, yeah, no kidding. We do. We really do. We're lucky.
I'm sure a camera operator from that movie would like come up to you and give you a whole lecture about like, you damn kids with your digital cameras.
I hope somebody listens to that. Actually,
that would be awesome.
Who was a part of that? And it's like, here, listen to me, youngster. I'll tell you what's up. That would be great. I would love that.
Yeah, just listening to him be like, I couldn't see stuff. Just like I'm sure it would come off as like that kind of like entitled, like, I can see I turned on the brightness on my MacBook, and that guy just shows up at your house and just kicks you in the nuts.
I just cranked my ISO up. That's all I did, guys. Is that good? Is that what I need to do?
Yeah, exactly. But no, I totally understand it. I think it has a lot to do with that style being in its infancy. And I think that what you mentioned about the dynamic between Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto, I think it about being it, you know, related a little bit to that kind of like biracial buddy cop movie.
That
kind of regressed a little bit. Like it feels like they took that dynamic and made it so much more simplistic.
Right,
it's lighter regarding to like race issues.
Right, exactly. I feel like they did strip that, which is a little frustrating. But they also was like, hey, this dynamic is great. Like we were just talking about, like you, Octave, were saying, like I wish there was more of that dynamic. So yeah, they might have taken like that idea and said, let's make it all about that dynamic, but then at the same time lost sight about what makes Across 110th Street.
Well, I did say that I would like more of Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto. I didn't say I want three Rush Hour movies.
No, I agree with that 100%. That's the producer mentality, though. That's exactly like what worked in that movie. We're gonna do it again. We're gonna just keep doing it. So that,
or you know, the second 48 Hours movie was crap, but the first one's at least like pretty good.
Oh, yeah, the first one. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, you know, I think we've all kind of said our piece about Across 110th Street. Should we move on to our overrated, Eric? What do you think?
Let's do it. Should I just dive right in?
Okay, so our overrated is Ridley Scott's, in my opinion, forced crime epic. 2007's American Gangster, starring Denzel Washington, Russell Crowe, and pretty much every single character actor and rapper you can possibly think of. So this is also Eric's pick for overrated. And yeah, Eric, why'd you pick American Gangster?
Well, I actually, it's amazing how fitting these films, how perfect to merge these films together.
Yeah, they're really close.
Well, two also, Harlem set crime stories.
Well, and you know, American Gangster even uses the Bobby Womack song itself. Exactly. And I gotta say, well, I'll just start right there. This movie is like a shameless ripoff, and it's like a mashed together pieces of so many great movies we've already seen. Yet it's overstuffed at like 2 hours and almost 40 minutes. It's amazing how overlong this movie is, but like also how rushed it is.
Yeah.
And I don't get this late stage of Ridley Scott, guys. I need to know, like, help me out with this. Like, late period Ridley Scott, it's not even that he's bad, although he's made some bad
movies. That's the problem. If he was bad, he would be memorable.
Exactly. He's made some bad movies. I thought Exodus last year was pretty bad. And
Exodus is shit, man. Yeah. Like, that's just a terrible
I'm so happy
movie.
I skipped out on that.
Oh, it's so bad. But what's the deal? He's just making these sort of... American Gangster's probably one of his better efforts of this period.
Which is kind of sad.
It's sad. I think that's sad. So I want to start there. And Ryan, I can hear you. Ryan, I want to hear what you have to say in defense of the film. I want to go from there.
I do really like this movie. And like I get now that, you know, it came out in 2007. I was younger, more getting into film. And so, like, I hadn't seen a lot of the movies that this movie clearly apes. Like, I now that I've seen The Godfather, all of them, I've seen Scarface, like, I know the influences of this movie. But yet, I feel like as an old-fashioned crime movie, I think it really works. Like, I think the performances are really excellent. I know, I hear you snickering over there. Sorry.
No, I was coughing, actually.
Oh, were you?
That was okay. Completely involuntary. I wasn't trying to, like, troll you.
No, it's okay if you were. I have no problems with that. But I think the performances are great. I also think the style of this movie, too, is very, like, akin to a movie like that. Like, it's not super showy. Like, when Ridley Scott tries to ape his late brother, Tony Scott, like some of these late-era movies... I don't think he does it as well as his brother did. But
I actually wish Tony Scott made this film, to be honest.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, well, he even borrows Denzel Washington, who was a frequent collaborator with Tony. So, I mean, I guess, yeah, I could see that. But I don't know. I like the old-fashionedness of this movie. Though I will admit, some of his more late-era movies we're talking about, like Prometheus or The Counselor, I think those are fascinating movies. Like, I've actually gone back to those movies because there's...
I'll give you that.
There's weirdly interesting about them, but, like, I think this is a strong movie. Like, I do think it's a strong movie for I don't want to say for what it is, but I mean, it is. I think it's just a very strong crime epic. That's what I would say. Maybe that's not a strong argument, but that's just how I feel about it.
That totally holds up. And I think there's nothing wrong with enjoying this film, and I don't think it's a bad film at all, and that's kind of the problem, is that...
it's safe.
To me, it's extremely safe and extremely forgettable. I mean, I watched this on...
Yet it's extremely, like, sadistic at the same time.
True, that opening scene.
This movie is tonally all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. When he lights a guy on fire and then proceeds to put 6 bullets in him after that. Well, like, don't get me wrong, there are spasms of, like, hyper-violence in this movie.
Yeah, it tries to be edgy, but tries to keep it safe for, like, respected general audience epicness of it as well.
Right, it's like Godfather Scarface line that is trying to tow that like elegance of the Godfather essentially, and that slow pace, but yet the Brian De Palma type of like horrific violence that happens in that movie, and the rise and fall arc, of course.
Yeah, I think the problem for me is that it's forgettable because it's a middle ground flat line through and through. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get terrible at any point, I don't think. Like, there isn't one memorable scene that I can think of and say, like, oh my god, that was, like, ridiculous. And I can't think of any scenes that just, like, really struck out for me and stuck out to me. And, you know, like, I watched this last Friday, and we were supposed to record on Saturday, and I actually started getting worried because we, you know, a couple of days were going to pass because we're recording on Tuesday. We're going to pass, and I started getting worried that I was going to have to watch it again because I know for a fact that before last Friday, I've seen this movie twice. Mm-hmm. And I can give you every single detail about, like, I've seen it in the theater and then I've seen it on, you know, DVD. I can give you details about, like, where and which friends I watched it with. And even watching it for the third time last Friday, I could not remember a single thing from it. Like, it was like a brand new experience all over again.
Yeah.
So it's just like this. And I think the main problem is that it is so... It's enjoyable, yet it just goes through that, like, flat line, you know, we're just gonna cram down a crime epic down your throat. Like, they were just, like, going for, you know, this is going to be, like, a Godfather or Scarface-level classic while they were making it, if that makes any sense. Like, they were just like, oh, this is what it's gonna turn into. Obviously, this is gonna be a classic.
True, they probably did think that. I mean, there's such a prestigious talent involved. I mean, especially you got Ridley Scott directing, and you have Brian Grazer producing, and Steven Zillion writing the screenplay. I'm sure you're right. They probably thought, this is gold. We got this. This is gonna be great.
See, and there you go, guys. That's, I think, what makes this movie, like, not that great. I mean, exactly. I'm with you, Octay. It's not awful, but it's on paper, I think everybody just thinks it sounds amazing, and the movie sort of hits all the beats, but doesn't really do any of the work to get there in the story. I like, take for instance, I have a really big problem with how easy everything is for the Denzel Washington character in this movie. Like, he just figures out a way to smuggle cocaine. He's a guy who's all about cutting out the middleman, right? So he can make his way and sell a better product. And he's not only that, this is technically a biopic. This is based off of real characters.
Yeah, yeah. And the real people were around the set apparently the whole
time. Yeah, and right, I don't care if the movie adheres to what happened or not. It's a movie. So, but the point is that people, this is supposed to be rooted in some level of reality, yet we never get the amount of detail we get in something like Across 110th Street or other great crime films like The Godfather. Exactly. Like in The Godfather or even Scarface. They're different kind of crime films, but what makes those great? Or Once Upon a Time in America, the fantastic Sergio Leone crime epic, right?
Yeah.
Those films feel like lived in and like they I don't know, I just think the work is done, whereas American Gangster somehow feels overlong but chopped down from like a better 4-hour cut even.
Exactly.
Well, there is a 3-hour cut, director's cut.
And Ridley Scott always doing,
that's the one I watched for the third time.
Okay, I watched
and it's still not better.
Okay, yeah, I just watched the theatrical cut, so I don't know.
No, the director's cut, I think, is like 15 minutes longer, and I just realized that after watching it when I went on IMDb that it's supposed to be an hour, like 2 hours and 40 minutes long, something like that.
Yeah.
And the one that I rented was like 3 hours long. But yeah, the director's cut version, I don't know what's really added, because like I said, I don't remember the first two times I watched the theatrical cut, but it still doesn't work. It has the exact same problems that you mentioned.
I mean, take for instance, this is what I was trying to get at, is like how easy it is for the Denzel Washington character to get the drugs. Where does he go? Does he go to Vietnam or?
No. Yeah, it's the in. Wait, I forgot where it was. The soldiers smuggle him when they come back to Vietnam.
He just happens to have a cousin that's like in war and that knows all the right people to ask for. Like the movie does zero work, and it just happens that he can just go upriver by sheer force of will. Like it feels very movie phony. Bullshit. Like,
well, that kind of convenience actually happened in real life, but like you said, this is a movie, so you're supposed to tell it in a way that's not just a retelling of, you know, like a flat retelling of like, oh, this is what happened.
Exactly. I think this movie suffers from it being a biopic, and that Ridley Scott felt he had to make it more epic, that it had to span a greater period of time. But what if it was just about Frank Lucas, the Denzel Washington character, learning how to smuggle drugs in so he can do his product? What if it was just about that? You could make a fantastic 2-hour, like, I'll get into, you know what I mean? Like, I guess what I prefer is more of the minutiae, the like work, something that directors like Michael Mann or Steven Soderbergh, they tend to obsess over that stuff.
Yeah.
Sergio Leone, in different ways, he sort of expands small moments, but like, I just think all of those styles handle this type of material even better. Like, even Brian De Palma with Scarface, and I would also add Carlito's Way, which I think is a movie that's fair in comparison to American Gangster, but is just so much better, I think. So much better. And Brian De Palma has a goofy side to him that's lacking in something like American Gangster, but like, it all works with his stuff. And I think what I... another thing that really bugs me about American Gangster is that there are some good performances, but I also feel like nobody's really doing anything extraordinary. They're all kind of plain versions of characters they've done before. But also, some of the characters in this movie and the actors in it look like they're just playing dress up. Like, can I just throw out there the...
Especially the rappers.
Okay, that, because you got, was it RZA from Wu-Tang?
Well, you got Commons RZA, in you it got as well.
Common.
T.I.
Yeah. Okay, how about the actor John Ortiz that is in the beginning is the partner to Russell Crowe? Is it me or does he just look like he's playing dress up in like a Max Fisher version of Serpico or something like that?
There's that.
Yeah, that's true.
This movie has a huge budget, yet it has these bizarre, like, people look like they're playing dress up. It doesn't feel lived in. I feel like this movie was really rushed. There's, I don't know.
One of the weaker aspects, I think, because like I don't think this is a perfect movie. I do agree with some of the issues being brought up. Josh Brolin's performance is another kind of issue for me. Like,
he belongs in like Scarface more than this movie.
Yeah, and that he's just like, he's almost, because Josh Brolin has that very stern, hard ass look, you know, the flat top of Flintstone proportions, not necessarily this movie, but you know, he's got that hard ass look to him. Like, it's easy for him to fall into like the cartoonishly badass character, which he does in this movie, or something like the Old Boy remake.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like that performance is very problematic. It's interesting you also brought up Michael Mann, because there's a very clear Heat influence in this movie in terms of between Denzel Washington's Frank Lucas and Russell Crowe's character.
But it's tacked on at the end of the movie.
I was about to say, the ending is, if anything, the biggest problem I have with this movie. Because what if, just big time, because what if, you know, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro at the end of that movie, like, settled it over a cup of coffee, even though they're already halfway through the movie? That's essentially what happens at the end of this movie.
And what if the last half of Heat was also mixed with, I'm blanking on the name, the Spielberg movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. God, I'm just blanking.
Catch Me If You Can.
Okay, add that to the last half of Heat and then speed through it in 10 minutes and you have the ending of this movie. It's just, I don't know. It's so frustrating to me.
Yeah, the ending is really rushed, and what you mentioned about this film being in this really weird place of, you know, it feels bloated, it feels overlong, yet it feels short at times. Like it should have either been like a, you know, 2 hour long, 1 hour and 45 minutes, just focusing entirely just on like maybe Frank, you know, Denzel Washington's character's operation, or should have maybe turned into like an HBO miniseries or something like that.
Yes,
and that
yes.
could have worked a lot better, because then you would get all these details, like what Ryan mentioned about, you know, it's kind of like that Unbroken situation where it's like you get this ending that says, you know, these two opposites have become, you know, really good friends. And that's very interesting because you're talking about mm-hmm. a by-the-book cop who becomes friends with a guy who's still, like, I mean, he gives up a bunch of people, but he's still a person who destroyed thousands of lives.
And brutally murders
people. Brutally murders people. And you have this kind of, like sitcom ending almost.
Yes!
Like, they're just like, that ending is bizarre as fuck.
It's
like,
they're so just bizarre. Out there
and like, oh, this is what Harlan looks like now, huh? And like, nothing happens in it. And it's a 5-minute long scene, and it's there at the ending, and it just like kills whatever momentum that you got getting there. You're just like, oh, fuck, when is this gonna end now? Like, we know it's over. Mm-hmm. And it has like these weird editing choices everywhere where it just feels like some stuff is just bloated, some stuff is not long enough. And yeah, I feel like, you know, knowing the production story as well, because this was put into production like I think a year before it came out, and that's not, I don't feel that's enough time to you know, like Leone worked on Once Upon a Time in America for 12 years. So, you know,
and it shows.
And Ridley Scott just jumped in from Antoine Fuqua, and I'd like you guys to think about how that movie would have turned out.
Wow. I guess we can be thankful for this version, then.
I'll give you one example, The Equalizer, for you to, like, wrap your minds around how Antoine Fuqua's American Gangster would have turned out.
You know, but that's an interesting thing in terms of Denzel Washington and choices he's been making in his later career. Yeah. I think it's... I don't know. We've kind of... praised, I think, Ryan, you said the performances are good in this movie. I don't know. I don't think Denzel Washington's great in this movie. I'll hand it to you here in a sec. I'm sorry. Yeah. Like,
no, it's okay.
I just think he can do this sort of his thing in his sleep, and I'm getting really bored with the tics. He's using the same tics in a movie that came out last year, as you said, The Equalizer, Octay. I don't see much variation in the characters other than they get more sadistic, yet we're supposed to love them all the same. Yeah. And I'm really bored with this character that Denzel is stuck on. Like, good or bad guy, he's doing the same things.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And maybe this is the start of that, or mm-hmm. you know, maybe, and so maybe I'm a little bit more forgiving, but you said, Eric, you haven't seen Flight, have you?
I have not. I need to, right?
Okay, that's a great movie, and it's an excellent performance that he gives, because
I will watch it. I will
rid of the tics to that point. Like,
that's good.
Yeah. Because definitely, I mean, even, you know, like a perfectly enjoyable movie like Unstoppable or Taking to Pelham 1-2-3, it's that same, like, he's not necessarily sadistic in those movies, but he's like too much the good guy, I guess, or he's too much the like sociopathic bad guy. So I guess there's, you know, maybe more balance would be preferred.
But you can never hate a Denzel Washington character in his movies. That's what I'm getting at. Right. Like, he, even when he plays a guy like Frank Lucas, and the character in The Equalizer, who's like as psychopathic as the Joker in the fucking Dark Knight, like, you're supposed to love that guy. I don't know. I guess I love the Joker more because Heath Ledger actually gave a performance and created a character. And, I don't know. I think Denzel Washington needs like a Magnolia, he needs something like to really like a character actor part. He needs
it's hard to do at this point because he's almost nearing 60 and he played these kind of archetypes so much that even, you know, I don't know what he would need to do in a movie for the audience to not like him anymore.
His movies are still also pulling nine figures into the box.
Yeah, exactly. That's why he's not changing, right?
That's why he's not going to do it, yeah.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, that's true. The thing about the tics, especially like with films like these where he has those tics, I feel like he's trying to nail some kind of tic or a catchphrase into the film. And this one, the one that really bugs me is that he keeps saying, "my man." And it's just like constantly over and over, even at places where it doesn't fit.
Uh-huh. It's like that SNL skit where they did the commercial for Unstoppable, where it's just the only dynamic was the fact that he's too old and Chris Pine's character's too young. And every time he insults him, it's Jay Farrow doing Denzel Washington. Yeah. He's just like, "my man," every single time. And it's becoming a reality, sadly, in these movies. Yeah.
So he's trying to make that stick. And the casting is a big part of it. And I think the biggest issue is Ridley Scott, who lacks passion to deliver a huge, like what's supposed to be a huge crime epic. And you know, the biggest problem, of course, is setting out to make a movie with the motivation to turn into a big, like, classic crime epic. Because none of those films that have become that, they weren't, you know, like, they weren't, like, setting out to be classics. They weren't making Scarface so that, you know, nobody who was making Scarface said that, you know, in 10 years it's going to be, like, this music style called hip-hop, and then all these, like, hip-hop artists are going to, you know, like, they didn't know any of that shit.
And Francis Coppola never took the material in The Godfather very seriously. Yeah, exactly. He just made it the way he thought it should have been told.
And that was a gun-for-hire thing.
Exactly. Anyway. Exactly. The way he looked at it, it was. It was a total gun-for-hire.
And he brought passion out of it. And there's a lot of stuff in American Gangster that, on paper, is really interesting. And if they had given it to someone like, you know, I think Tony Scott is a good example. Because, you know, think about Denzel Washington and something like Man on Fire, where... The violence in Man on Fire is very much in your face. It's very, you can feel it. You just get, you know, it's like uber stylized and whatever. It's not a perfect movie, but you know, when the violence kicks in, it accomplishes its goal. And I think it's the same thing with something like True Romance. And in this one, for example, like, you know, me being you know, I read a lot of scripts for work, and you know, if I saw in a script the very first scene is someone tied to a chair being burned alive and then like shot six times, and those are the very first lines in a screenplay, I'd be like, this is fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. And you know, on paper it just sounds so awesome, and then you see it on screen and it just has this like flat, you can see the what they were going for, what he was going for, but I just get this like flat feeling, even in moments that are like really abundantly violent.
Yeah, it's like the moment, the it's like a, I guess around the midway point where Idris Elba, the great Idris Elba, is really wasted in this movie.
Yeah.
And then his character is dispatched of in a way that is supposed to be shocking, but it kind of for me encapsulates like the tonal confusion of this movie. And to be honest, in Denzel Washington's performance, like, I don't think he plays that scene right, nor do any of the other actors. They all just, it's a very strangely handled scene.
Yeah.
Yet I'm with you, Octay. I bet on the page that scene read like so badass, right?
Yeah, like, the guy just like shows up
cold-blooded,
puts blood in his head in like broad daylight with, like, you know, in the middle of Harlem. It's supposed to show you how much power this guy has,
but yet then
it's very
then
effective on paper.
It is, but then it feels like the next scene, all those people are just, they're his brothers and like his family, but they're just like blindly following him. It's an odd, like, one piece does not fit to the other. It's like, it's a strange, like, trying to, you know, put a square, you know, what is it, a round pole in a square peg or whatever.
Square peg in a round hole.
Thank you. Yeah. It's like trying to do that. And I don't feel like the movie adds up. It's kind of messy in that way for me.
Yeah, definitely. I can totally see that, and that's part of the problem of, you know, either take stuff out or add stuff in, and the kind of rushed quality of the production, kind of, you know, like the some of the subplots don't really go anywhere. Like, for
example, oh god, yeah,
the thing, like, T.I.'s character, he's Common's he's supposed to be Common's son, and they're like 2 years apart from each other or something.
And he's a baseball player.
He's a baseball player and doesn't go to his meeting because he wants to be a gangster, and that's conflict.
And it comes and goes like all these other random moments in this movie. Yeah, yeah.
And what I love about how that turns out is that he just gets shot in the neck in the background, and that's it.
Yeah. That's it.
And that, like, there's no close up to him or like some kind of tragic, like, oh, look at what happened, he was going to be a baseball guy. No, he just gets shot in the middle of the gunfight. That's it.
Yeah. Hey guys, this movie was up for two Oscars. Do you remember
I was supporting actress for Ruby Dee.
Okay.
And like one of them must have been like production design. I don't remember exactly what it was for. Yeah.
They were obviously hoping for a hell of a lot more than that.
Oh, I know. And I was worried it was going to. I got to be honest. I'm glad this movie wasn't. But let's look at that Ruby Dee nomination. Now, you guys,
Lifetime Achievement.
This is one of the most shameless Lifetime Achievement nominations.
Yeah.
Because I'm like,
I would agree.
It's even worse than the Titanic actress. You know, remember?
Yeah.
Like, she at least played a central part in the movie, the way the story was told in Titanic. In this movie, Ruby Dee has like 4.5 scenes, and cries and then sort of looks confused for the rest of them. Like,
and then slaps him, basically.
And slaps him. She never gets any moment where you could even be like, there's your Oscar clip. I know it sounds mean. She's had a wonderful career, and it's great to honor that, but also, like, it just kind of shows how laughable sometimes Oscar nominations
are. Yeah, I mean, that's straight up, like, Lifetime Achievement...
Pandering
gone way too far.
If I were an actor,
you're in a movie and you're about to die, let's give you something.
That's what it feels like. I think that's more shameless than rewarding her for an actual good performance. I don't know. Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
I would be kind of insulted. That's what happened with Peter O'Toole when they were going to give him like an actual Lifetime Achievement Award, and he was just like, "I'm not dead yet."
Yeah, and yep. And then he was nominated a few years later for a movie called Venus, which he was excellent in that movie. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But yeah, Rudy D is you know, like, just forget about all her stuff from the 60s and 70s. Just her role in Do the Right Thing is enough for her.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
Just to point and say, like, here's how this amazing actress did an incredible job.
She's one of my favorite characters in Do the Right Thing. Like, exactly. Yeah. She's so memorable in other stuff. It's a nitpicky thing, I will admit. But I thought that when this movie came out, and it honestly, I feel even a little more soured on it having watched it again recently. I'm just like, she's a nothing character in this movie. And it's just, it's odd that this movie was even up for any conversations in terms of awards. I think if it was more of like a Scarface, like, kind of crazy sort of crime movie, you know, like Scarface ups the more outre elements, then it doesn't take itself as seriously as something like The Godfather, right? And that's what makes Scarface great and different. But American Gangster's this, again, it's, to me, it's just so tonally confused. It's like Ridley Scott is an interesting director only in that he only seems to work in a very specific set of circumstances. Yeah. Like, he has to have a really good script, or also his design specialty, the things he's good at, like, you know, creating worlds, has to work for the story that's being told. So, you know, you get classics like Alien and Blade Runner, and I really like Gladiator. I really like Thelma and Louise.
Yep.
But other than that, I don't really know about him as, like, I kind of laugh now when he's cited as like a visionary director. I just think he's, think he's just been working long.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
He's a workaholic.
It's kind of frightening a little bit now that you mentioned, because he has to have a good script. Like, I'm assessing the screenwriters who have done his last few films and kind of now realizing he might be the problem. Like, I mean, Steven Zillion wrote this script.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good script, actually. Yeah. I mean, maybe not the way that it ended up on the screen, but the individual scenes are written really well.
Yeah, absolutely. William Monahan wrote Body of Lies, Oscar winner for The Departed. That movie's not great. But
Cormac McCarthy wrote The Counselor.
Damon Lindelof wrote Prometheus. Brian Helgeland wrote Robin Hood.
Man, I still haven't seen Robin Hood, but I hear that's kind of bad.
It's not bad. It's just,
it's the same thing. It's forgettable immediately. Yeah. Like, I can attest to, like, the 2000s Ridley Scott movies, I can tell you for sure that I've seen, there's like two or three of them that I can, like, vouch for seeing that I don't remember a single scene from. I think that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And
Russell Crowe. Maybe him and Russell Crowe need to, like, stop. I don't know.
Give him a break.
Give him a break.
a friend style break. Just be like, hey, maybe you guys break up a little bit. And, you know, he did that, I guess, with Exodus. He's not in that, right?
Thank God.
Or is he like the voice of God or something?
No, he's not in it. God is the only interesting element in that movie.
Oh, it's like a little kid, right?
Child, yeah.
It's a petulant little child. Of course, that doesn't work very well either within the movie, but it is an interesting concept, just not executed well at all.
So I understand you picking this movie as an overrated, Eric. Like, it's clearly very problematic, and I don't disagree with it. I enjoy it as a surface level crime movie, but it doesn't aspire to be anything more, and I can't argue with that. But as far as late period Ridley Scott, except maybe The Counselor, I've gone back a few times to watch that movie just because it fascinates me.
It's got two scenes alone that make you have to see that movie for at least two.
I'll definitely check that out. And
yeah, it's worth seeing just for those two scenes, but just to see how it works necessarily.
Uh huh.
But this is probably his best late era movie. Like for better or worse, take that in the spirit that it's intended. But
yeah, I actually think I'd agree. I mean, and I guess I'm not counting Gladiator. But if I say post 2000s, Gladiator is still my favorite.
Okay, by far. That I would,
agree. And that just makes the cut because that's like 2000. Yep. Straight, yep. Isn't it?
On the dot.
Too. And that one won Best Picture, you guys. So, I mean, like, kind of crazy to think about. You know, I don't know if it deserved it, but yeah. No, it was a good year, too. Probably Traffic should have won, but, you know, or Crouching Tiger, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, Soderbergh got the best director for that, so.
That is true. Very deserving, too.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't know. You know, Ridley Scott, we also forget about, what was the Black Hawk Down? He was nominated for director for that, but that movie's kind of been forgotten quickly.
Yeah, it was. And it was a big deal when it came out, and then it just like fizzled out immediately.
I honestly forget that that's him and not Tony Scott who does that. Like, I really, not to belittle either of them at all.
No.
It's just way more akin to Tony's style, that movie, than Ridley's.
You know what I mean too when I say I wish Tony Scott would have made American Gangsters. I think he would have made something. I didn't love his late period of sort of gonzo experimental visuals, you know, but right. I do, it's like you, Ryan, I really appreciated what he was always going for. And I think if he had good material like American Gangster, he could have brought that style to it. And it would have been like more of a, I think it would have been better if it was more Scarface, less Godfather, if you guys, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
More camp, more or less like pandering, or not pandering, ponderous self-seriousness to it.
Attempts at it.
Right, attempts. That's
I think the Russell Crowe character could have either been, you know, not taken out, but like minimalized and, you know, given to a maybe a smaller actor, because everything with him, you know, it's just like the Al Pacino and Heat rehab of, you know, by the book cop who's workaholic, whose home life is like, you know, just completely in shatters, and just goes through the same exact motions.
It's like faux complexity. His character's pretty like one dimensional, but they try to make him good and bad, and I never bought it.
I mean, it's what the court case essentially that tries to make him, give him a little bit more dimensions. But yeah, I mean, especially in the beginning of the movie, like when they find that trunk of cash, it's like it's a very clear, easy decision for him to just give that up, even as his partner's saying, like, you know, people don't like cops who rat out other cops.
You did a better New York accent than fucking John Ortiz.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I'll take that.
And I like that actor. You know.
Yeah, I do too.
And he's wearing the same kind of makeup right now too.
I would have loved a character actor that was in this movie, a part of Russell Crowe's like recruited team. John Hawks, I think, would have knocked that character that Russell Crowe. He would have knocked that part out of the park, dude.
Even Norman Reedus, who's in this movie too, might have done a better job. Like I'm
from Boondock Saints.
Yeah, I mean, he gives a more layered performance in The Walking Dead. I'm not going to talk about Boondock Saints. That's a conversation for another day.
Exactly.
Or just not at all ever.
Agreed.
Just bury that. Those two movies even exist, along with that douchebag piece of shit that made them. I don't know if you guys have seen Overnight. That's a great
scene. It's like
you want to reach into the screen and just strangle that entire piece of crap. But
so, anyway, there's other character actors, like you said, who would have knocked out of the park.
I don't know. I feel like I've kind of laid it out there. The movie's just problematic for me, but I think, Ryan, you've made good points. Like, it's not awful. It's certainly not awful.
It's not. That's kind of the problem.
Yeah, and it made a lot... Exactly. It's why I think it's kind of fizzled out in terms of any pop cultural impact anymore. Like, it's I guess why it's good Ridley Scott just keeps working, because... Yeah. He's just like, seems like a guy that's just trying to put as much work out there and see what happens, but he's yet to really hit in a while. So,
true.
You know, I'm often going to check out his stuff. I'm always hoping for the best, but
Turn into a producer. He's doing a better job as a producer. You produced the Philip K. Dick based The Man in the High Castle. That the pilot episode for that was amazing.
I can't wait to watch that, and it got picked up.
And he's producing the Blade Runner sequel, so
we'll see about that.
I'm not too sure about that, but he's got this movie The Martian coming out later this year. Another great screenwriter, Drew Goddard, so hopefully he doesn't
great cast. He's got Kristen Wiig is in that movie.
Jessica Chastain, Matt Damon, Kristen Wiig, Sean Bean.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Donald Glover. Shit, do you think Sean Bean's going to die in that movie for sure?
I don't know. He did not in Jupiter Ascending. Spoiler alert for Jupiter Ascending. Yeah. But no,
you son of a bitch.
How dare you spoil that sci-fi masterpiece.
Hey, wait a minute. What's Jupiter Ascending?
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
I don't know. It's already gone, right? I don't even know what that
Eric
is anymore.
Eric gives the perfect answer you can possibly give to that piece of shit film.
Oh, man. That might be a good spot to end it. That's a good...
Yeah, I think exactly. I think so.
After talking about these two like really interesting Harlem-based crime movies, let's end on a really shitty space opera.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think we all made our good points, and I would say Across 110th Street, definitely, like, if you're into that kind of stuff, go check it out. And you know, I think what Ryan said has a lot of truth to it, is that if you haven't seen, you know, I can totally see how much people would enjoy this if you haven't seen Godfather or Scarface or all the movies that it's, you know, Heat, all the movies that it's like influenced from. Definitely, like, for, you know, I could totally see that. But yeah, it's definitely like a very problematic film that kind of just disappeared over time.
It's a good entry point. Like, if you know that those are the movies that it's borrowing from. Yeah.
Yep. I would actually say if you've seen American Gangster and liked it, but haven't seen a lot of older crime movies, go back to the ones that we've cited all throughout this episode. Yeah. And there's so many more. I mean, I would even throw Serpico in there.
Oh, yeah.
See Serpico if you liked American Gangster. It'll give you a much better version of the Russell Crowe story, because it's a film that actually focuses just on that angle.
And the facial hair looks more realistic, too.
Definitely.
It's because it's real, baby. Pacino went full hippie for that shit.
Exactly. Yeah. There's none of that, like,
you rush, always go rush full hippie
player stuff going on.
No, you always go full hippie.
All right. Never go full retard, but always go full hippie.
That's there right. I bet Pacino would say that.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's cut it out there. And thank you so much for listening to Over Under Movies. And we're going to come up with another overrated and underrated movie for the next episode. So make sure to keep an eye out for that. This is Octavia Kozak, film critic for DVD Talk, Oregon Herald, The Playlist, and BayAspider.com.
Oh, I'm Ryan Oliver, internet film critic. I forgot my cue. I'm sorry.
Internet film critic extraordinaire, Ryan Oliver.
Exactly.
No, it's Ryan motherfucking Oliver.
That's right. Yeah. We decided that was going to be. That'll be my intro next time. They're my picks next time, so I'll do that. Yeah.
Antonio Fargas from Across 110th Street would be proud if you did that. So
I will make him proud.
All right, signing off. I am Eric McClanahan, film writer for The Playlist and Oregon Arts Watch, and I also have a film podcast called Adjust Your Tracking.
All right, thank you. Bye.